The following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. We're glad you could join us. And before we get started, I want to just remind you that just because you hear something on the air today or see it on a website, whether it's ours or anyone else's, and whether it's ours or anyone else's radio program or podcast, as the case may be, please don't rush out and try whatever strategy you think might fit your particular facts and circumstances. Let's have you check with your existing advisors, accounting, tax, legal, real estate, mentors, etc., and make sure that what you heard is was accurately portrayed, and that further it could be interpreted to bring value to your individual, unique facts and circumstances, because almost everything we talk about is a fit for someone. It just may not be you. And you need to understand specifically how you're going to be affected on going forward. And again, nobody's a magician. None of us have the crystal ball, if you will, but we can at least look at pro forma information about your project and help you understand the math behind what you're signing up for. It is, in almost every case, it's about the math. I mean, there are some intangibles like integrity of the syndicator or sponsor, but we're counting on you to vet those issues, because our risk tolerance may be different than yours. So we'll suggest you connect with investor relations staff. And if you want to ask us questions or ask us to do three-way calls with those folks, that's perfectly acceptable. Once you're a client, of course, and we will give you our inputs on pretty much any variable you want to talk about. You know, we are coming up to the end of the current fiscal year, and so today of the government, September 30 is that deadline. And so I think today and tomorrow I'm going to really zero in again on the U.S. debt scenario. You've heard, or I've heard, a lot of talk in Congress this week and with government officials, and they seem to express dismay, but I don't see any action. You know, we're still spending, outspending our tax receipts each year by $2 million. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, which theoretically calls the balls and strikes on legislation that comes out. They look at how it will impact our, well, among other things, they look at how it will impact our go forward in terms of the cumulative debt increase or decrease. And it's been a while since we had any decreases, but we've had smaller deficits. And I guess I shouldn't say that. I believe there was one year in the Clinton administration because the GOP, Newt Gingrich, had Clinton in a headlock, basically. And there was one year that we did not have an increase. I believe we were close to a balanced budget. But in any event, that's an anomaly, the way our current group in Congress spends money. And for that matter, for the past, 40 or 50 years, it's been horrendous. And it's gotten really bad here in the last 15 or so years. You go back to George Bush Sr., I guess, is when, right after his administration, I guess that would be Clinton, is when it started. And it exacerbated under President Obama and Trump. And it's gone crazy under Biden. And but for a friendly Democratic or independent senator or two, Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin, boy, it would be significantly worse. Thank goodness they voted against several initiatives of the Biden administration that would have caused the debt to spiral even further out of control. And for those of you that aren't aware, and I've referred to this site many times, and I would urge you to get familiar with it. It's the usdebtclock.org site that has a real-time snapshot of many of the government spending objectives personified, if you will. And the dollars are clicking along real-time. And the current U.S. national debt is $35,406,406,000,000, according to this chart or this site. The portion per citizen, if we were breaking this down to how much do each one of us theoretically owe, it would be $104,921. And if you look at it per taxpayer, which is probably the number that matters, it's almost $270,000. It's insanity, absolute insanity. But let's drill down a little bit further, and let's look at the four largest budgetary components. It's Medicare and Medicaid. I want to refresh this window. These numbers don't look right, but let's see. Well, I don't know. It didn't change, so I guess it is. Medicare and Medicaid is $1.8 trillion. That's the largest budgetary component. Social Security is next at $1.4 trillion, and almost $1.5, closer to $1.5. And then until just earlier this month, defense would have fallen into the third slot at $929 billion. But now interest expense on the debt, our interest expense on the debt, has surpassed defense. We're at $953 billion, and I believe once all the ducks come home to roost here next week, on the 30th, we're supposed to be just over $1 trillion. And I'm assuming that the U.S. debt clock is using the same economic basis or calculation as most of the economists do, because I've seen more than a few economists make this comment that we're going to be in the third spot with interest expense or debt service here before the end of September. So it's at $953 billion. First time in our history, I believe, that we spent more than we do on defense. Defense is roughly $930 billion, and interest is roughly $953. It's crazy how fast and how high that number's gotten. And, you know, you ask, well, what are we going to do? And I wish I could tell you, because there's no common agreement in Congress as to what's the best way to pay this down. And, of course, the Biden administration wants to keep spending. Well, all the administrations want to keep spending. I as much as I like the good things that Trump provided, and I think he'll do it again if elected, it's not going to be without raising the deficit. I mean, there's nothing that both sides are talking about, the Democrats and the Republicans, that would cause the deficit to recede. And that's what needs to happen. And, you know, in Kamala Harris's plan, if she is elected and increases the tax, which is her stated goal, it'd be one thing if Congress was going to use, if it passes, if they would use the tax increase to pay down the deficit. But that's not the plan. The tax increase is going to be used to pay for assorted progressive programs and paying down you know, the cost of mortgages. In other words, they're going to hand up to, I believe it's 160 on a mortgage, and that's, you know, in terms of helping certain people get being able to qualify for a mortgage. They're giving us a down payment. And then there's also a $25,000 giveaway that, again, takes money. And I guess I only have one question, is how are you going to pay for it? And it's probably going to be from people that are paying taxes. It's unlikely that there will be a direct tax increase on the lower levels, the lower tax brackets. But the lower income people will still get the brunt of any inflationary increases, because they don't stop and think about the unintended consequences when they talk about tax cuts and tax increases. And, you know, the inflation is the silent tax increase that everybody pays, and it's brutal in terms of the impact. Let's do this before we continue. We're going to talk about how do we as individuals address the oncoming onslaught of taxes that are going to have to occur to avoid calamity in this country. And by that, I mean a major, major depression that we will face 4 to 5 years, maybe 6 years down the road. So we'll circle back momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Thank you.
People always coming up to me and asking, what's your secret? With all you do, your attitude just seems to be so good. How do you keep it? Get to living, giving. Don't forget to throw in a little forgiving and love along the way. You better get to knowing, showing a little bit more concern about where you're going. There's a word unto the wise. You better get to living.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195, 713-581-0195, or you can send an email to nathan@npross.com, nathan@npross.com.
Did you know 76% of Americans are concerned they won't have a secure retirement? BeAPlanner.com shows how private real estate partnerships can increase current cash flow and retirement savings. There are three options to control your 401 and IRAs, but only one will double your retirement lifestyle. BeAPlanner.com for the Be A Planner Show with CPA Nathan Ross.
Like the song, Bobby McGee, I'm just longing to be free. Take me where I want to be. Big dreams and fantasies. And there are many just like with big dreams and faded dreams.
Okay, welcome back to more of this week's Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And we were just talking about the significant increase in our cumulative debt over the past, 20 years is probably when the bulk of the current $35 trillion has been accumulated. And of course, you know, there's some among us, not us, but there's some economists out there that believe you can spend your way out of inflation and recessionary trends, etc. There's one crowd that believes you can print as much money as you want as long as you provide it to consumers to put it back into the economy. And it's never worked before, but just like Ms. Harris' proposal to fix price gouging, I believe she called it, I think she meant gouging, it doesn't work when you can't identify, you know, if she could only define what price gouging is and show us some examples, who knows, maybe we would agree that there's price gouging. But you know, the examples that she's cited thus far, like groceries, I'm not sure that 1.6% profit margins or gross margins, even, I think that was the gross margin that Kroger reported, I believe. And I don't know, that's going to be a tough argument to win. So I think she better start with some of the other industries. And I'm not saying there's not any, but I'll tell you, it's not like she thinks, and that's the problem. Most of the world is not like she thinks. It's being economically illiterate limits your ability to process, you know. And I wish the best if she gets elected, but boy, I tell you, it's a limited scope if you think about it. If your understanding is such as hers seems to be. Let's see, I was going to look. There was an article that just came in earlier today. I've referred to Jamie Dimon, and we are going to come back to the budgetary, the debt problem that we have, but I just saw this pop in, and I wanted to see if he was still skeptical or if he was changing into an optimist when it comes to the you know, the recent rate cuts and the impact it's going to have on our economy. But anyway, so here's the article. It showed up, let's see, what time do we get this today? Oh, wait, early, 5:20. No wonder I missed it, 5:20 a.m. Let's see, over the years, J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon has often been skeptical of the economy, even when most other voices and otherwise, or said otherwise. From March until April this year, he stood by his estimate that there was a 65% chance of a U.S. recession. He's still insistent on the need for caution. And as he said last year, The reason is geopolitics. It's geopolitical, essentially. Geopolitics is getting worse. They're not getting better, he said in an interview with India's CNBC, as reported by CNBC. There's a chance for accidents in energy supply. God knows if other countries will get involved. You have a lot of tug-of-war taking place. He called geopolitical instability his biggest caution. And I would agree. I mean, you know, who would have thought if you backed up 20 years or 30 years, who would have thought that if the Middle East was in the turmoil that it is right now, that we wouldn't be paying $10 a gallon, I mean, for gasoline. It's just crazy that we're kind of just going along as usual. Everybody acts like we're not sitting on a powder keg in the Middle East, and yet, I don't know. It seems to me we sure are. It seems to me that Iran is kind of in the driver's seat with the current administration, and you know, it still seems like the current administration is determined to get Israel to bend its knee, if you will, with respect to the fighting between Hamas and Hezbollah, which is effectively paid for and directed by Iran. And so I don't know. The president again said, I believe it was yesterday, that he thinks settlement can be reached, and I would just suggest that, boy, there's been settlements before, and then eventually the fighting starts again, as promoted by Hezbollah and Hamas. It's not typically Israel. Israel's reacting, and you may differ on the severity of the actions that Israel takes, but boy, I tell you, when you look at that country and how it's surrounded, it's amazing that they're able to live through some of the attacks that have happened. And I tell you, I've said many times, and I'll say it again, the U.S. should outsource our military effort to the country of Israel, because anybody that can survive with their geopolitical structure, it's amazing. Diamond continues his point about energy, with obvious references to the war between Russia and Ukraine, as well as the rising conflicts in the Middle East, is clear. Aside from the pandemic, or as the pandemic showed, rather, supply chain disruptions can turn economies upside down, and energy prices were at times one of the biggest factors in climbing U.S. inflation. And it's a huge factor inflation-wise, but boy, it's a huge factor, period. And when you look at our lives and how much we count on the petrochemical industry. Goldman Chief's Chief Financial Officer Dennis Coleman took another view, as he told CSNBC recently. He thinks the Federal Reserve's 50% basis point interest rate cut put the country on the path to an economic soft landing. I think it's way too early to assume that, but so be it. Before that, it occurred after the 2008 the debt malaise, or the global financial crisis is what they're calling it here. I think this first 50 basis point cut is a clear signal in terms of the new direction, Coleman said. And hopefully that will unlock incremental amounts of confidence and should obviously reduce the cost of capital. I'm not sure. I mean, that's, you know, in the short term, perhaps, but I'm not certain there's enough strength in many sectors of the economy to get us back to where we were. Coleman further said it is always a tricky job to manage economies through transition, but you know, inflation levels are coming down, employment is manageable, they're still starting to put through the interest rate cuts and sort of maintain a soft landing trajectory. Without taking sides, there's always a case for risk management, and there are signals that the economy might not be all that it seems, and I tend to agree with that. Consumer confidence slipped in September, according to the conference board. The drop from 105.6 to 98.7 was below expectations. The two-year Treasury yield fell some in reaction. Federal Reserve Governor Michelle Bowman was the sole dissenter on the U.S. size of the rate cut, preferring the 25 basis point level instead of the 50. As my statement notes, I preferred a similar initial cut in the policy rate while the U.S. economy remains strong and inflation remains a concern, despite recent progress, Bowman wrote. Although personal consumption has remained resilient, consumers appear to be pulling back on discretionary items and spending, as evidenced in part by a decline in restaurant spending since late last year. Low and moderate income consumers lack extra savings from pandemic support. We pretty much spent through it, is what I read consistently. Perhaps it's best to remember, as Diamond does, that certainty is often a luxury when trying to discern the future. Boy, you got that right. Speaking of, if you look at, let's see if I've got this article handy. It's about how that the, let's see, the cap rate. Well, first of all, let's take a look at an article where a CMBS specialist, that's the commercially backed mortgage market, predicts a three-year cycle of increasing multifamily distress. And we're starting already to see that in some of the transactions that we review, where the ability of a syndicator to unload a property where maybe they're not going to get all the capital back, but they're not going to go under to the point where the guarantors have to step in, the non-recourse key principal type guarantors. And I just looked at a transaction in last week that had a scenario where about 35% of the capital was available to return, but 65% was not. And I've seen other transactions where we were looking at it for a client that was looking to acquire a certain building, and they were dealing directly with the lender at that point. So the prior syndicator presumably didn't get any capital back that they could return to the investor. So that's certainly out there. That's kind of your worst case scenario if you've got your money invested in syndications, is that the syndicator is not going to be able to maneuver or operate the asset in such a fashion to wait for things to come back. There's roughly, and I'm not sure if it's this article, I'm scanning it real quick to see, but commercial real estate debt is somewhere in the $1.5 trillion dollar range. And of that, I think approximately 650 to 675 maybe is multifamily. A lot of it is office. Office is in bad shape. But the multifamily assets are still attractive if you're walking up and able to acquire them at, maybe a 70 to 75% market discount over what it would cost to build or otherwise buy in good times an existing property. And so there's a lot of dealing that's starting to take place as the market falls. And the 50 basis point cut has allowed a little bit more of a synchronization to occur between the buyers and sellers of existing properties. And this particular article indicates that as the early parts of a three-year cycle get started, there's definitely going to be more distress and higher special servicing rates. So, you know, most lenders don't want to own the real estate. They want to get rid of the loan. They try to liquidate it the best price they can, and therein lies opportunity. Just remember, people are making money when the pricing values are going down, and they're making money when it's going up. It's in large measure a timing-centric model. Let's see. Do we want to hit another article while we're getting ready to do the next break? Let me see what I've got on the list. Here's the article I was looking for. Capital rates normalize amid a stabilizing market. Let me take just a peek here and see how long of an article this is. We may likely want to go to a break. Well, it's not that long. Let's over the past several weeks, real estate experts have seen signs of stabilization in the market, particularly in the multifamily sector. And by the way, the difference between the office market and multifamily is rather striking. I mean, it all, I think, comes back to the concept that everybody needs a place to lay their head at night. They don't necessarily need a place to work. You know, the pandemic with all the remote computing more or less showed that. And so the market right now for office is just, it's never been worse, I don't think, since they've been tracking it. But that's not our focus. We're focused primarily on the multifamily space. And so again, this article's talking about how that, you know, the valuations may not immediately respond to the 50 basis point rate cut. But it is, there is some adjustment going on where sellers are thinking, well, okay, this gets me a little bit closer, or it may allow them to hang on longer. You know, it's not necessarily gets them closer to a strike price from somebody that's sitting on the sideline, but may get them the ability to pass out some distributions to the partners or otherwise get current or more current on their debt service. One of the quotes is, I'm optimistic that we're at the forefront of the next cycle. So this is from a senior managing director of mortgage banking at Berkadia, who is in the know on multifamily loans. They do a ton of multifamily loan business. The bid-ask spread that's been persistent for the last 18 months has largely come together. We're seeing a lot more groups who were on the sidelines now coming out to acquire deals. He goes further to point to increased transaction activity in recent weeks as a positive indicator, attributing it partly to reduced volatility in the 10-year Treasury. Yield. The 10-year Treasury is a common delineator of rates, especially in the funding for multifamily. Often 10-year terms are used, even though the amortizations may be over 20 or 30. So the 10-year is kind of a benchmark, if you will, that affects commercial real estate pretty heavily. In any event, several barometers and indicators indicate that things are slowly going back to normal. Let's see. Well, I'll tell you what, we are at the break. Let's go ahead and take our second break, and we'll circle back momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195, 713-581-0195, or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com, Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough.
Okay, welcome back with our final segment of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA, and we're talking about the deficit and its impact, or the rate cut and its impact on cap rates and transactions. You know, the cap rate is not directly tied to the interest rate, but they seem to go pretty much in lockstep. Maybe take a little while when there's a rate increase or a rate cut to sync up, but you know, there's no way, there's no impact of these rate increases that we had, and now we're getting a cut that'll eventually filter through to the cap rate that investors require or lenders require to buy a property or to refinance a property. And, you know, the lower the cap rate goes, the higher the value becomes. And conversely, the higher it goes, the lower the value is. So as the rate started going up, you know, the units got more expensive to acquire, and there's more risk with respect to the buyer. So the market really has gone into a deep freeze as of late. I'd say over the last year or more is when it started. And it's just now starting to thaw. you know, it's interesting when you look at the 10-year look that CBO does. You know, it's not interesting. It's incredibly depressing. You know, the projected deficits for the next 10 years are an average of $2.1 trillion. And that's not considering the goodies that Harris, both Harris and Trump, are saying that they're going to offer. You know, not taxing tip income, not taxing Social Security. Now, again, these are concepts, as Trump might say. These have not been passed into law, and the odds that they get passed into law, I would say, directly correlate to which party controls Congress. And I mean controls Congress, not, you know, has one house or the other. And I don't know that that's going to happen, but if it does, if we take on more spending, well, then all the numbers we've just talked about will go up fairly dramatically, just like they have before. I know, you know, we use COVID or the pandemic as a convenient reason that the debt has skyrocketed over the last 10 years. But the reality is there's a lot of spending out there that didn't include COVID. And that's what the fear is. As taxes go up, now, if you look at the plan by Harris to raise taxes, it's in large measure going to cause significant spending that will try to use some of it to pay down the debt. I don't know. I haven't heard her say that, but I know that some of the GOP congressmen are starting to make those noises because they were just faced with having to do another continuing resolution. We haven't passed a budget in 20 plus years now, if I recall, and we just keep doing continuing resolutions or CRs upon continuing resolutions upon continuing resolutions. That's all we've done in terms of authorizing our budgetary spending. And we're coming down to the last component of the, that's discretionary under our current rules. And unless the rules change on indexing future years, cost of living increases, et cetera, maybe the age of retirement for Social Security, there's a number of things that Congress can change. And that's the rationale they maintain for why we don't put the true debt, the roughly $150 trillion on the country's balance sheet. And it's you know, not just the fact that it's $150 trillion, it's the fact that we are now over the 100% of GDP mark, which used to, Congress would take comfort in the fact that we had not surpassed the their line in the sand in many cases. Which was we were under the 100% of GDP mark. Well, now they don't bring that up, unless you do, because they're well over it. And in any event, the ability to borrow is going to go, well, it's going to be greatly diminished here in 4 to 5 years when we can no longer cover 100% of the interest on the debt. Think about that for a minute. The full faith and credit of the U.S. government does not mean a whole lot these days. And I'd suggest to you that you want to get your money, if you've got money in retirement accounts that are not Roth or otherwise tax-free, money that you're counting on to live on the rest of your life. And by the way, you may be surprised to learn that average males are supposed to live, according to the IRS life expectancy tables, we're supposed to make it to age 85 to 86, and females are 87 to 88. So now tell me you've got enough money in your retirement account. And let's assume you're thinking this year's tax rates, where you cap your calculation, the most you could owe on the required minimum distribution that you have to take, assuming you know you are in pre-tax accounts, would put you in the 37% bracket, maybe the 40 to 41 if you've got the wrong type of income. You've got investment income that's subject to that additional 3.8% Obamacare tax. And so that's a lot of money if you're looking out over the next 20 years when you have to start paying that. You're still healthy, you're still living. Whereas the alternative is to convert it now while you control, you know what the tax rate is. You know that you can pay the conversion tax now, so you're in control of when that happens. And if you can do that, then you're going to keep a lot more money in your retirement accounts. The CBO did a study back in 2009 where they Congress had asked for a report to show them what we would have to put in place tax rate wise to negate the cumulative deficit, and the numbers were staggering. The tax brackets, each of the three brackets, the 10, the 25, and the 39 at that time, would need to go up. They need to be raised, each of them, up 150%. So the 25% bracket would need to go to, the 10% bracket would need to go to 25. The 25 would need to go up to 63. And the 39 at that time, it's now 37, the highest bracket. Back then it was 39. The 39% bracket would need to go to 88%. That's over and above the current rates. Excuse me. And so now tell me how much money you have in your retirement account. Now that you understand that, hey, you've got to pay the IRS when you take those RMDs out. Hey, let's do this. Let's take another break. I'm throwing the producer a curve. Can we take that break? I need to get something, excuse me, to drink.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna warm it up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough to take control and make it.
Okay, welcome back. Sorry about that. I've had a scratch in my throat all day today and needed to do something. Okay, so avoiding the onslaught of increased tax brackets, which is going to have to, the solution, first of all, is going to need to be systemic change in our policies. It's not a little bit, it's a lot of bit that's got to change. So you're going to see, I think there's inevitably, the math will dictate tax increases. Now, whether you split it evenly between corporate and individual, or whether it's all individual, or whether it's spending cuts to a certain degree and some tax, I mean, that's all to be cited, but bottom line is our gross domestic product is currently about 20, end up close to 29 trillion this year. It's right now, it's real time. I'm looking at it on the U.S. debt clock. It's 28 trillion, 600 billion. And so we're spending in excess of that for the current year by about $2 trillion. And so, you know, CBO, again, they project $2 trillion all the way out to 2034, and that's their, they look at 10 years. So converting to Roth is your solution. That's one of your solutions. You could also look at perhaps selling some of your, if you're not in an IRA or 401, you could sell some of your assets and convert them to index universal life, where you'd have some cash value that has some unique capabilities. But bottom line is, if you're leaving your money in pre-tax accounts, I would suggest, you know, if you're in the 20 to 24% bracket right now, you're looking at least 50% tax treatment, just based on common sense and the ability to use a calculator. And so that means you've got to, if you thought you were safe at a couple million dollars, well, and by safe, I mean self-insured, you're going to need to double and you know, have 3 million or 4 million available to be able to withstand the tax. And that's assuming you leave it as pre-tax. Now, if you take it to Roth, then you're going to pay the tax now. And the beauty of these multifamily investments, which are private companies, are that we get to discount the value that we're going to pay tax on, and it's significant. So if you have any interest at all in doing Roth conversions, you've got to look at the opportunity to invest in multifamily apartment buildings simultaneously, or another private company option you may have. Most of us don't, and that'll help you minimize the Roth conversion tax. Well, we're coming to the end of the show. We'll be back tomorrow at 11 a.m. right here on AM 700 KSEV, and we'll pick up with more discussion, just because we're sitting here at the end of the fiscal year, and this is near and dear to the news cycle. A lot of talk, and I want to help people that think there's nothing they can do. There most assuredly is. So connect with me if you want to discuss this with your personal facts. Okay, well, thank you for listening. We hope you can join us tomorrow right here on KSEV, the voice of Texas.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.